everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2025, and you're listening to episode 448, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about season 2 of the Star Wars Disney Plus series, Andor. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. Cole teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes, and he writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a TV series review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called, "We Used Up All the Perfect, Andor and the Limits of Star Wars." And you can read his review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you on again.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, as I've mentioned in past episodes, we are starting our summer season of episodes, and Cole will be joining us on a regular basis because there's so much pop culture that's coming out that we need to address, because so many people are going to be watching those films and we need to have ways as Christians to interact with them. And on the front of all of the films that are coming out, we want to talk about a television series. As I mentioned in the intro, this will be spoiler filled. So if you have not finished watching Andor season 2 on Disney Plus, you might want to turn this off, or be fair warned, we're going to be talking a lot about plot points. But just to start us off, for some people that might not even realize that there is yet another Star Wars show, television show, that's available to stream, why don't you tell us a little bit about Andor and how does it fit into the larger Star Wars universe? Because we now have had several television shows and also there's the films.
Sure. So Andor is essentially a, let's call it a character-driven espionage drama set in the early days of the Rebellion, just before the events of Rogue One. So if we're talking big picture films, it's between episodes 3 and 4, Revenge of the Sith, and then the original Star Wars from 1977, which was retroactively titled A New Hope. At the show's center is Cassian Andor, who was the, I guess what you would call the secondary protagonist of Rogue One. And Cassian is a man who sort of begins the series, you know, very disillusioned, sort of self-interested, quite morally ambiguous, but who gradually becomes this very committed soldier, spy to the Rebellion. So it's really a show about the slow grinding path to resistance against tyranny. And I guess you could say it trades in like the grit and the gears of Rebellion, not in this big sweeping myth of heroes and destinies. In terms of the canon, of course, if you're talking the expanded material, not just the films, it's going to fit pretty snugly between the Clone Wars and Rogue One, overlapping the time period of the show Rebels. It's technically within the timeline, but it feels almost like a genre transplant. It's more like John le Carre than Joseph Campbell. So it doesn't rely on the Jedi or the Force or the Skywalker saga. It carves out this space for ordinary people in the Star Wars galaxy who are dealing with, you know, fear, compromise, the cost of doing the right thing under this oppressive imperial regime. So it's canon in content, but it's canon seen from the ground and not the throne, as it were.
I think it's a little unique too, because it's a prequel to one of the lesser known films, which is a setup for A New Hope, which is the original 1977 film from George Lucas. So it is kind of leading up to the events of A New Hope through these two seasons of Andor. And also, our listeners might not know, what's interesting, I can't think of another show that's done it quite like this. Maybe you can. But over the course of these 12 episodes, they sent them out a few at a time. And every time some new episodes dropped, was it like 3 at a time or 4 at a time? 3 at a time? It was a time jump. So they were over quite a bit of ground in season 2.
Yeah, my understanding, and this I freely grant that this is speculation on my part. I've read a lot of interviews with the show creator, Tony Gilroy. But my suspicion is that a lot of this material that was used in season 2 was part of the original plan. It's my understanding that, and I don't know if this was when Tony Gilroy came on or if this was before he came on as showrunner, because there was another guy attached to Andor before him. But the original template was a 5-season plan. And once, you know, the rubber meets the road, they sort of realize this is extremely expensive to make. We're not going to get 5 seasons out of this for budgetary reasons, for time commitment reasons, so on and so forth. I sort of got the sense that the second season suffered as a result, because the things that happen in these 3-episode bits are all, from what I could gather, divvied up from the 5-season plan. So the first season is very contained, but then you get to season 2 and you basically have 4 mini seasons in season 2. The first batch of 3 episodes, time jump. The second batch of 3 episodes, so on and so forth, all building up to the ending. So I don't know if that was always in the cards. My suspicions is that it wasn't, because it feels a little butchered, at least from just the initial viewing I had. And I'm sure all of that content was stuff that was taken from the original 5-plan design, or 5-season plan, I guess I should say.
And one thing I would say about this show is it's got a little bit different tonally in terms of parents wanting to know about this show, because I know that so many kids, Christian kids too, love Star Wars, maybe grew up watching the Clone Wars animated and Rebels, and then graduated onto the shows, or maybe their parents showed them the original 1977, which is a very clean, by today's standards, just very PG film, and nothing overly scary or disturbing or anything like violent, things like that. But what should parents be aware of going into the show? Because I definitely think this show is, specifically the second season, PG-13, but some of the actual themes to me are rated R.
Yeah.
Some situations. I'm not talking about the overall theme, which we'll get to.
Right.
Some of the situations that they posit are, I don't, unless you've had some really frank talks with your kids, I don't know that you would want to expose, like, let's say a middle schooler to this.
Mm-hmm. No, I thought the same thing, especially in the second season. There's at least one scene that comes to mind that I couldn't believe it was in Star Wars, period. And there, the cynical part of me sort of looks at it and goes, this scene was completely contrived by someone who just wanted to say, we put this in Star Wars. Simply because nothing of real consequence seems to come of it. But that being said, this show is, the first season is very firmly in PG-13 territory. I know that they had to sort of dial back some of what they wanted to do. They were sort of told no and things like that, which made sense. But this season in particular, it does feel as though the envelope is pushed maybe a little more. So I would say that for parents, understand that Andor is not made for kids in the way that much of Star Wars traditionally is. There's no real cartoonish villainy. There's no real slapstick relief. Instead, it's quiet. It's slow burn. it's at times it's very unsettling. The themes, to your point, are pretty, I guess, heavy, as the kids would say. State violence, political oppression, the moral cost of revolution are all themes that this show is dealing with. There's also a fair bit of mature content. I would say there is nothing, there's nothing sexually explicit or gratuitously violent by modern standards, but it's definitely more intense than most Star Wars entries you've got.
And I think it's not sexually explicit, but it is implied.
It's suggested, yeah. I mean, it's a spy thing. So, you know, there are, if you're just talking about genre conventions and genre tropes and things like that, you know, you've got the sort of suggestion of sexuality that the James Bond films are very known for, and things like that.
But drug use is implied.
Yeah.
It's violence against women is definitely implied.
It's very grimy. Yeah. And then on top of that, you've got, you know, prison labor camps, execution squads, scenes of torture, which again, more so suggested rather than shown. But I think it's more so this, tone of existential dread that is sort of unrelenting. For older teens and adults, I can see how that is incredibly compelling. Personally, I'm sort of in the camp that, okay, this is sort of old by this point. It's this sort of deconstruction type stuff has been done to death. It was done to death 20 years ago. We've tread this territory already, not necessarily in Star Wars, but in the just in the broader cultural zeitgeist. You know, as I've said on this podcast before, I can only stomach, I love the crime genre, big fan of, you know, crime stories and books and things like that. But there comes a point where I can only stomach so much of the existential dread type stories on screen, simply because I get tired of watching bad people be bad. It sort of becomes boring after a while. It becomes predictable. It becomes redundant when you just watch morally compromised people make morally compromised choices all day long. So for older audiences, I can see how this type of thing would be compelling, especially in the context of Star Wars. But for younger viewers who are expecting lightsabers and droids, you know, just the stuff that Star Wars is known for, it's likely to be confusing or just too bleak for those people. And to be fair, the show is not marketed, nor does it cater to those audiences. So if someone does have like a 6-year-old watching Andor, I'm gonna say why. just to put a fine point on the point, as it were, some of the students, the high school students I teach, when the second season came out, they were watching it as it was releasing. We were talking a little bit about it, and one of them made the observation, "It's really hard for me to watch." And I sort of said, you know, why is that the case? Because I'm expecting him to say, you know, it's just too different or whatever. Instead, he goes, "Because you actually have to pay attention and you have to keep track of everybody's motivations and follow why they're doing what they're doing and then remember why they're doing what they're doing." And, you know, one of the other students sort of laughed and she made the comment, you know, This just shows us how stupid we are. We're not used to watching television shows that expect something of the viewer. And we had a good laugh about that. But I actually think there's a point laden in what she's saying that I think she's very right about. This is a show that demands something of the viewer. It expects the viewer to be able to pick up on, you know, I hate the word subtext, but because it's a spy show, there's a lot of stuff that's said in coded language. You know, things have double meanings and so on and so forth. And the show expects the viewer to follow that. And you're not going to get that kind of traction with young audiences. So that's stuff that parents should be aware of.
It's now the month of June, and so the Christian Research Institute is heading towards the end of our fiscal year, and I only ask twice a year for you guys to think about making a partnership donation to the Christian Research Institute, because when you do that, you are supporting the work of the Christian Research Journal. And we used to be a paid subscription magazine for more than 45 years. And now everything is completely free at equip.org. And our website does not have a paywall. And you have access to thousands of free resources, including videos, audio from our podcasts, and also the Bible Answer Man broadcast. And of course, many decades of free articles from the Christian Research Journal. So we hope that you will consider being a partner with us. You can do that through a one-time donation, and that goes directly towards sponsoring the Christian Research Journal. And we believe that our authors who do a lot of original research for us are worth their hire, and we do pay them. And so that goes towards us being able to continue to giving you the free articles. There's one every single week. You get a new one. And also to support this podcast. You can also make a donation for featured resources that we highlight on our website, as well as you can think about becoming a support team member. What that is you would be equipping us monthly or quarterly or annually with a recurring gift. So you can set that up and forget about it, and you would be giving us a monthly recurring gift or whatever time frame you choose. So thank you so much for thinking about partnering with the Christian Research Journal through the work of the Christian Research Institute. And go over to equip.org/donate to get to our donation page. And now back to my conversation about season 2 of Andor, the Star Wars series on Disney Plus, with Cole Brigette. Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about just this, you know, the overall themes. We started touching on them when we were talking about, you know, is this suitable for younger children? But what's really kind of, you know, you mentioned the grit and the grime, and I would say, you know, this is not the Coruscant of the prequels, which was glamour and beauty and beautiful waterfalls. This is a very gritty underbelly kind of showing of Coruscant, one of the main planets where the Senate is. So what is going on overall with the show, and kind of what was the progression of season 1 and 2? And we mentioned this is actually a prequel to the film Rogue One.
So in this most recent season, season 2, we're sort of watching the noose tighten, as it were, around the neck of this fledgling rebellion. Cassian is no longer drifting. He's now orbiting the rebellion. Season 1, which for my money was unquestionably the better season, follows Cassian coming into the space of the rebellion. And it culminates, that season sort of ended with Cassian seeking out Luthen Rail, this wonderful character played by Stellan Skarsgård, and in a sense selling his soul to the devil. That's sort of how it felt. It felt a little Faustian when he finally goes to Luthen and says, you know, whether you're going to kill me, if you're not going to kill me, then take me and use me, you know, make me a weapon, basically. And this season picks up with him firmly entrenched in that world, with Luthen as his kind of handler. And the show begins to stitch him into the broader resistance network, particularly through characters like Luthen, obviously, and then later Mon Mothma and Bail Organa, who has been recast from Jimmy Smits, who's played him since the prequels. Is now played by Benjamin Bratt, and Mon Mothma played by Genevieve O'Reilly. So it's setting up a lot of the infrastructure of Rebellion, how the movement funds itself, how it communicates, how it navigates the internal moral compromises. So it's very much about the nuts and bolts of a revolution and not just the rhetoric of the thing. And so it's my understanding, and once you see the second season, you know, there's nowhere else for it to go. These two seasons are it. This is the show, season one, season two. And it does take viewers directly to the doorstep of Rogue One. This show ends with Cassian going off to meet the contact that he meets at the beginning of Rogue One. And in even the interviews I've read with Tony Gilroy, that is sort of what has given Andor its narrative clarity. It knows exactly where it's going. It knows exactly where it has to end. I'm pretty sure he's talked at length about knowing exactly what the last moments of the show would be and where they have to get to. But it also, you know, that creates some limitations. There's more story to tell, but it's finite. You know, they're not building a saga here. They're just building another bridge, as it were. So as far as what's going on, it's still dealing with the themes of the first season, all of that spycraft, all of that subtle nuance, all of that, you know, moral ambiguity is still there. It's just that Cassian is now more entrenched in the rebellion than he was before.
So this is pretty interesting because you're talking about just where we find ourselves in this series. And so how does this, and it's building up to Rogue One, which is really a kind of standalone film. It features characters that people hadn't ever heard of before. Now they totally know because of Andor, focusing on Cassian Andor. But Rogue One as a film featured a lot of unknown characters that was leading up to the events of the original 1977 film. So, you know, speaking of the 1977 film, how do you think this show in its grittiness, its, like you said, existential dread, matches with the original tone of the 1977 film that was done by George Lucas? Because the Andor series was done by Tony Gilroy. He was the main writer on it and executive producer. But what is the difference there? Because there were jokes. There was just a lot more camp in it, maybe a little bit more whimsy than, just like I said, the dark underbelly of Coruscant type of a series setting.
Yeah. Tonally, no, not really. And that's both the point and the problem for my money. When we talk about things like hermeneutics or interpreting a work, when we do this in Bible study, you know, one of the things that we always begin with, especially for a work that has aged beyond the time in which it was written, is authorial intent. What was the author intending to do? You start with that. You don't start with, well, what this means to me, what I got out of it. You start with what the author was attempting to do. And that's always helpful when you have the author sitting there to explain to you. But when you don't have that person, you're forced to rely on the text itself and be very meticulous about the grammar of the thing, about what the words meant in their original context. You have to sort of do all that study. Well, with George Lucas, the fortunate thing is we still have him, and we have wonderful interviews that have been preserved with George. And so George Lucas has famously said that he made Star Wars for 12-year-olds, particularly 12-year-old boys. It's for the kids sitting in the dark trying to make sense of a very complicated world. And I think that is probably the first thing about Star Wars that fans forget. Once you become an aged adolescent, you are in fact no longer the intended audience of Star Wars. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. That doesn't mean it can't be your favorite thing on the face of the planet. It just means that you are no longer the person it's made for. It's not a dismissive statement to say that Star Wars is for kids. It's actually foundational. Lucas saw Star Wars as a modern myth. It was this cultural scaffold, if you will, of moral formation. And he wrote this largely due to his conviction that kids were growing up without fairy tales in the 20th century. Which, here's the thing, is he was right. If you look at modernism, if you look at modernity and what it brought in and the skepticism that it brought in and the science is God-ism that came in, it's true. Myth and wonder and you know, it doesn't mean, you know, you just believe in whatever in fantasy, but it means that this sense of transcendence was being stripped out of Western thinking. And a lot of that was tied up as the product of two world wars and so on and so forth. And Lucas as a, let's say Lucas, the cultural anthropologist, was watching this happen in real time and felt convicted by this. And so he created Star Wars as sort of the antidote for that, which has very serious implications for someone who is trying to approach, you know, this from like a Christian cultural apologetic standpoint. He borrowed very directly from Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, which everybody seems to know this about it. But this idea of the monomyth, the journey of the hero, the ultimate triumph of light over darkness, the original trilogy is about hope. It's about destiny. It's about ultimately redemption. And even the prequels, flawed as they are structured around tragedy and consequence in this grand operatic mode. And this is often the thing that I think sort of slips by people. The stuff that they often complain about in Star Wars, well, the dialogue or the campiness of it, that is the point. I understand the complaint that, oh, it seems cheesy. It is. It's not made for you. It's not made for the person who sits there and goes, oh, that's cheesy. It's made for the person for whom being exposed to binary morality, good, evil, that's a first for them. It's meant to shape the mind of the kid. Lucas talks about all of this. And if you look at my article, you'll see a link to it in there. In this interview he gave with Bill Moyers back in 1999 when The Phantom Menace came out. Star Wars is a story that deals in very, very strongly painted archetypes. And whether or not you think that, you know, archetypes are a good way to study literature or anything, whatever, that's what Lucas did. It's not that Lucas, you know, slipped accidentally into archetypal writing. He very intentionally constructed the thing to mirror that. The fallen hero, the wise mentor, the tempter, the chosen one. It's all very, very intentional stuff. Andor doesn't traffic in any of that. It deliberately avoids myth in favor of realism. It's about systems, not symbols. It's about how tyranny actually works in the day-to-day grind through surveillance, through fear, through bureaucracy, through moral compromise. The Empire in Andor isn't a Death Star, even though that is a natural part of the storytelling. They get there at the end, because if you know the plot of Rogue One, the whole inception of Rogue One came from the idea of, oh, the first movie begins with them saying rebels stole the plans for this battle station. Well, how did the rebels steal the plan? Boom, you have Rogue One. Andor is leading up to that. But the Empire in Andor isn't a Death Star. It's a cubicle farm. Evil here is clerical, procedural. It's impersonal. It doesn't stride in with a red lightsaber and declare itself. It signs the right forms. It monitors the wrong conversations. It schedules executions for efficiency. Andor is asking a very different question than Lucas did. You know, Lucas sort of asked the question, what happens when you realize you're part of something bigger? And, you know, Gilroy sort of asks, what happens when you realize you're not? And you rebel anyway. You sort of make your own bigger. And it's important to note that this isn't necessarily a downgrade, right? In many ways, Andor is more mature. It wrestles with moral ambiguity in the ways the original films never attempted. There's no Jedi code to rely on. There's no ancient prophecy to fulfill. Instead, you have people like Luthen, who, very self-aware as he is, says he is going to, I think he says, burn his life for a future, to build a future that he himself is never going to see, that other people may benefit from. And then you have Mon Mothma, who is trapped in political theater, making these gut-wrenching decisions that's ultimately compromising everything she values. You have Cassian, who begins the show as this thief-type character and ends it willing to die for this cause, and will in fact die for this cause that he once despised. These are humans. They're not mythic. These are not arcs, if you will. But here's the rub. The tone of Andor is so radically different that it almost feels like it's not Star Wars at all. It's brilliant television. It hums on a different emotional frequency. There's no wonder. There's no mythic uplift. There's no John Williams swell when the hero finds his courage. There's dread. There's silence. There's bleakness that hangs heavy even when the good guys win. And that tonal dissonance matters. Because while Star Wars has always had room for darkness, think of Luke facing Vader, Luke being tempted by his own flaws, which have always been there. Rian Johnson was not the first person to give Luke Skywalker flaws. That was George Lucas way back in the original trilogy. Or even Anakin's fall. All of it was framed by this hope that good would win. And doing what's right would not just matter, but it means something in a larger cosmic story. That's what gave Star Wars its moral clarity. It's almost, you know, George Lucas once said of the Star Wars story, and many people know this, well, it rhymes. It rhymes. And it's almost liturgical in how much it rhymes, this story of fall and redemption and fall and redemption. Andor, in contrast, it doesn't really seem to even believe in that kind of order. It presents a morally chaotic world where meaning isn't given. It has to be constructed, often painfully and often without guarantees. So for longtime fans, or for parents expecting something like the movies they grew up on, Andor can be deeply disorienting. It is Star Wars stripped of its mythos, its force, its fairy tale roots. There is no chosen ones, no wise mentors, no last minute saves by a higher power. It's not that Andor is cynical exactly. It's that it mistrusts the very idea of clean heroism. That's a very bold artistic choice, but it also fundamentally alters the moral texture of the world we're dealing with.
Well, I also think that, you know, I do note that maybe even the audiences are different. Like you said, there is an intentional campiness and jokiness and just kind of good and evil, very binary in the 1977 versus this kind of universe that Tony Gilroy has constructed in Andor. And I'm just wondering, not only tonally watching it and kind of like you said, the existential dread, but also because there's no definitive good and evil, even the people who are quote unquote good make a lot of ethically questionable choices in Andor. And I don't know that we've seen the heroes do that on that kind of a scale. You know what I mean? There's just, everybody's kind of slimy. Everybody is, like you said, it has that spy kind of vibe to it. But not like Get Smart spy.
Oh,
like,
yeah, I see what you're saying. I agree with you completely.
Can we match that? Can we match this idea of Luthen kind of thinking, okay, here's the greater good, so I'm going to, in the process, burn people, murder people, work on my own? And it's seen, it's not seen as a good thing. I think a lot of people that are involved with the rebellion in the series think that Luthen is kind of rogue, pun intended, I guess, because it's coming up to Rogue One, but he's kind of doing his own thing. So do you think it's going, ultimately, do you think that this series works with all the other TV series and films and animated series with Star Wars?
If you're talking just aesthetic, I mean, yeah, I think it looks like Star Wars. It certainly doesn't.
Talking about the tone of there, when you grow up with the 1977 films and the ones that came after that, Empire and so forth, it's just more, even if you didn't really know what the Force was, it just seems more like good and evil. There's these good guys and these bad guys. Here, the good guys do a lot of bad things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do I think it works? This is probably pretty subjective. I'm going to say no. I don't actually think it works within the established. Again, it fundamentally alters the moral texture of the world that George Lucas created. And I am not someone who worships at the altar of George, right? I don't necessarily think George Lucas was the greatest, most ingenious writer at the time. I think he's important. I think he's certainly one of the most important creative minds of the 20th century, and not just for Star Wars. But I do think you have to understand that what George Lucas was doing was pulling from a very old tradition of storytelling. George Lucas was pulling from myth. He was pulling from the stuff that transcends time, space, and culture. That's how Star Wars was born, out of that type of storytelling, not 20th century sci-fi storytelling. That gave us Star Trek. Star Wars was cut from a much older cloth, so to speak, just dressed in, you know, planetary romance clothing. Andor comes along and fundamentally alters that moral texture. And that doesn't say that Andor is bad, but that is to say that it, at some point, I think it ceases to become Star Wars, at least in the sense of what Star Wars originated as. And I guess you could say, well, anything not created by George Lucas is just a riff on that. J.J. Abrams wasn't making Star Wars. He was making fan fiction. You could say Dave Filoni wasn't making Star Wars. He was making fan fiction. Yeah, but there seemed to be a, with Filoni, Favreau, with Abrams, with Johnson even, and his misunderstood film, there seemed to be a very intentional looking at what George Lucas did and saying, okay, how can we build on this, expand on this? How can we take this sort of same approach to myth that Lucas took and continue this story or put our own stamp on it? Whereas it seems very obvious that the Andor team comes to Star Wars and says, okay, we see that Lucas began with myth. We're not going to do that. We're in fact going to do the opposite of that. We're going to not treat this with any sense of humor. Or a sense of irony. We're going to treat it very straight-faced. In many ways, Andor is the kind of show that you would have expected from Star Wars in the early 2000s. It's a deconstruction, full stop, of Star Wars. It's which is something that we've deconstructed everything. We've deconstructed Batman. We've deconstructed James Bond. We've deconstructed everything but Star Wars. And no, The Last Jedi is not a deconstruction of Star Wars. People like to say that it is, but it is not. If you follow the storyline and the character arcs, it is not. This, however, is not just a deconstruction of characters. It is a deconstruction of the epistemology, even, behind Star Wars. So do I think it works in the sense that it fits? No. Do I think it's good television? Do I think it's good storytelling? Yeah, it's very well written. I love Tony Gilroy's work. I think I've mentioned to you Michael Clayton. His film Michael Clayton is one of my top probably three films ever made. I love it. It's what I call the last film that Hollywood ever made for actual adults. That's not to say it's an adult film. It's just that thematically it's a very mature film, the kind of movie that is not made today. The film Michael Clayton. So I love Gilroy's work. I just I don't know that how well this sits comfortably within Star Wars.
And also, we've talked so much about storytelling and myth and morality and the Christian worldview on this podcast through your coverage of pop culture for us. And by the way, we're getting to the point where people will be like, I don't understand, like, why does this matter to the Christian? I think this matters in a lot of different ways. One is Star Wars is one of the most beloved franchises ever. And it continues to live on because people who were kids in 1977 when they saw the film are trying to introduce the whole, you know, film to a new generation or generations since the film. Film came out, I think Gen Xers were young in elementary school, and then boomers were probably in high school, and they're trying to introduce their kids or grandkids to this whole universe. So it's a multi-billion-dollar universe still today. So it has a lot of resonance, even if people for the first time are being introduced to some of these things they didn't know about through some of the TV series on Disney. But I would say that it is very contemporary in terms of not just tone, but also in today's post-truth, you know, culture, the way that morality is displayed in Star Wars is very much of situational ethics. And I think that's where the majority of people, maybe even Christians, sadly, live. You know, I would never do that except for in such and so and so and so a case, then I would do X.
Of course.
I think that's what is happening in this series.
Yeah, this is one of the most intriguing questions surrounding Andor. Because what we're not talking about is just a difference between tone and aesthetic. It really is, and I despise the word worldview, but it really is a sort of clash of worldviews, if you will. And at the heart of that is this deep divergence in what we might call epistemology, how truth is known, and then what kind of truth is even possible. And in George Lucas's Star Wars, for truth is transcendent. The truth is sort of transcendent. It exists beyond the characters. It's accessible through the Force, which functions not just as this, you know, mystical energy, but as this moral compass, if you will, that is sort of woven into the very fabric of the universe itself. There's an assumed metaphysical order, and it's light and dark, good and evil. And to actually press into this part of this conversation for just a second, right? What I have found is that, and I was sort of, you know, surprised by this, even among Star Wars fans, people really seem to struggle to understand what Lucas meant by balance in the Force. There's this sort of idea that floats out now that, oh, balance in the Force means this walking of the line between light and dark. That is never what George Lucas meant when he talks about balance in the Force within the epistemological and moral framework of Star Wars. And several people have talked about this. So just to read some of this, at the Rebel Scum Con in 2024, Ahmed Best, the guy who played Jar Jar Binks, he actually talked about this. And in this interview, he said, and I quote, "Everybody gets the Force wrong." This is from George Lucas, not from me. That's him talking. He said, "Everybody thinks that the balance is the light side and the dark side, and that's not the case. The light side is balance. The dark side is out of balance. The dark side is easy. It's accessible. It's corruption. It's the easy way out. So when you're talking about the Force, when you're talking about being in balance with the Force, it's not the dark side versus the light side. It's the light side is balance, and the dark side is being the place that you don't want to go." Lucas himself talked about this. He says something very similar. There actually is a very coherent and consistent moral framework in Star Wars. There was a meeting of a writer's room for the TV show The Clone Wars back in 2010, and Lucas himself outlined this. He talked about it, and this is what Lucas said. What happens when you go to the dark side is it, that would be the Force, goes out of balance, and then you get really selfish. And when you get selfish, you get stuff, or you want stuff, and when you want stuff and you get stuff, then you get afraid somebody's going to take it away from you. Once you become afraid that somebody's going to take it away from you, you're going to lose it, and then you start to become angry, and that anger leads to hate, and that hate leads to suffering. And this, of course, in the book, this is sort of the best text for this, the book, The Art of the Mandalorian, which I have on my shelf. Dave Filoni, who created a lot of the TV shows, worked very closely with Lucas, sort of explains what Lucas meant by all of this. And this is what he wrote. He said, ultimately, the Force is an ability that can be used selflessly or selfishly, and how one chooses to wield it determines whether you stand on the dark side or the light side. The dark side of the Force is manifested by our greed, our desire for power, our fear, and the light side of the Force is propagated by selfless action, by living in balance, by overcoming our fears. The Force naturally exists in a state of balance, and that balance is thrown out when someone chooses to give in to their fears and then spirals out of control, making selfish choice after selfish choice. Fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, and then hate leads to suffering. Our own ambitions can make the Force into something terrible, even when our intentions have been good. We do not always realize we are acting out of fear or selfishness. Anakin, for example, believes he is trying to save his wife. He is afraid to lose her. He chooses to act out of his fears and try to control the situation. That moment of choice, how we act and react, is so important. The choice between light and dark is often subtle and not limited to Jedi and Sith. Everyone struggles with the balance between light and dark. In other words, the idea is the Force is thrown out of balance when someone goes to the dark side. The light side then comes along and creates a counterbalance to bring the Force back into balance. This is the whole point of Snoke's line in The Force Awakens, when he says to Kylo Ren, there has been an awakening, talking about Rey, who the light is bringing in to countermand Kylo's choices. Have you felt it? He even says to Rey in The Last Jedi, darkness rises and light to meet it. I warned my apprentice, talking about Kylo Ren, that as he grew stronger, his equal in the light would rise. So there is a very consistent moral fiber to the Star Wars films. Yes, even into the sequels that people say, oh, they don't get it. They get it better than most of the fans, actually. There's a consistent assumed metaphysical order to Star Wars. And while individuals can fall or be redeemed, those moral poles remain fixed. It's a universe where truth may be obscured or ignored, but never reinvented. This is deeply mythic, even quasi-religious. It aligns closely with classical and even what we might call Christian understandings of truth, that it is objective, that it is discoverable, that it is rooted in something beyond oneself. Andor is operating from a completely different framework. Gilroy and company isn't interested in transcendent truth. They're interested in subjective truth, constructed truth, political truth. There's no, as we said, Force here. There's no prophecy. There's no moral scaffolding that undergirds the character's choices. Instead, we're given a world where what matters is perception, persuasion, control of the narrative. It's a world where truth is tactical, something to be shaped and deployed, not discovered, not revealed and obeyed. This shift from mythic epistemology to a postmodern epistemology is massive. It changes everything about how the story functions. In Lucas's universe, heroes become heroes because they align themselves with something greater. In Gilroy's, people become heroes, if we can use that word, by sheer will, pragmatism, and degree of moral compromise. The goal isn't to embody virtue. It's to survive long enough to make change, even if it costs you your soul. Now, your question, and this will go in the direction of Christian apologetics. Can Star Wars contain both of those visions without collapsing under the weight of the contradiction? Franchise-wise, maybe. There's no question Star Wars has grown big and expansive enough, especially thanks to the House of Mouse, to have all of these varieties of genres, Western, romance, war drama, comedy, all that kind of stuff. You can have an animated kids show like Rebels and something like Andor exist in the same sandbox and overlap. The branding itself is elastic. But on a deeper level, on a thematic level, it's more complicated. Because once you shift those moral and metaphysical assumptions that undergird the story, you're not just offering a new perspective, you're redefining the terms. And at a certain point, it's fair to ask whether you're still telling a Star Wars story, or whether you're just using the iconography of Star Wars to tell a different kind of story entirely. Again, that's not to say that Andor is illegitimate. In fact, it's probably going to be the most artistically successful thing Star Wars produces in decades. But it flirts with the line between expansion and revision. It doesn't just explore, like, you know, the underside of myth. It questions the existence of myth altogether. And from a Christian standpoint, that matters.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because, I mean, we're talking about Christian apologists, which this is an apologetics and theology podcast. What are some of the maybe, I don't know, pitfalls, or what can you use in Andor as a springboard to bring it back out of this moral ambiguity type of a place where they're really promoting a non-Christian worldview in terms of how to even think about truth?
So before we hop to the question of, so then what can we say about this? We have to understand that why it matters from a Christian apologetic standpoint. And it matters because we're constantly engaging a culture that no longer shares a common vision of truth. Andor becomes a case study in postmodern storytelling, beautifully crafted, emotionally compelling, but epistemologically rootless. It gives us a vision of the world where nothing higher intervenes, and then moral clarity becomes impossible. That's powerful. It's also deeply at odds with the kind of moral universe Star Wars originally imagined, and the kind of moral universe that a Christian confesses. So the different approaches can be contained. But to your point, the question has to be asked when the epistemology shifts far enough and the story stops playing within the moral architecture it was built on, does it start to say something else entirely? For the Christian apologist in the room, what then can then be said about Andor? What points can we raise as conversation starters about this? Well, there is a few. First, there's just the question of moral formation. Go ahead.
And I would say that, I mean, my question is, when the average person today who's not a Christian say, I resonate with how morality is portrayed in Andor. In other words, even if you're on the good guy's side, it's not so black and white as it was when George Lucas made that, you know, really, like we were saying, very binary, here's good and evil. They'd say, well, I don't even believe truth or the world works like that.
They may resonate with it. It's that going that extra step of saying, well, I resonate with it because it's right. That's different. And that tends to be what happens. So when I have these conversations with my friends who are not Christians, who really resonate with this show, they resonate with it because that to them makes sense. It's right. This is showing the way things really are. George Lucas and his frou-frou light and dark side stuff, that's all childish. That's all ridiculous. That's somebody who doesn't really understand how the world is. This show gets it. That's the kind of stuff that I get. That's the kind of conversations that I have. And you also have to be able to press into the moral ambiguity of it as the Christian without losing sight of the fact that there is no moral ambiguity. Regardless of what one's experience is, it's not there. We have a very clear arbiter of what is right and what is wrong. And as far as the Apostle John was concerned, it's really easy to tell the child of God from the child of the devil. It's real easy to tell right from wrong. Andor is essentially the question of moral formation, right? If you're going to press into this with someone. Andor is essentially about how people become radicalized, but like not in a cartoonish sense. It asks, what makes someone cross the line from like survival to sacrifice? What makes someone choose martyrdom? That's a rich space for discussing like the nature of moral conviction, for discussing conscience, for discussing even vocation. Especially when, to your point, the good guys aren't saints. They're often compromised, conflicted, broken, that type of stuff. Second, the show foregrounds institutional evil, not just personal corruption. The Empire is not just bad guys in uniforms. It's a whole system of surveillance, oppression, dehumanization that opens up these powerful conversations about the nature of sin in a fallen world. It's not just personal rebellion. There are structural injustices that occur as a result. In other words, the whole system is broken. And the system the good guys are propagating isn't even really a better one. For my money, right, the best scene in this last season of Andor is, spoilers, after Luthen dies, and it is a very, let's say, unsexy death. It is not the way anyone will expect him to go out. There is nothing loud. There is nothing like greatly rousing about it. It's a very quiet. It's a very, oh, that's unfortunate. It's a very subversive, let's say, way for a character like that to go. Well, then as soon as he's dead, you know, the rebellion sort of demonizes him as being this loose cannon, this rogue operative. And Cassian has to sort of take them to task, even Mon Mothma, even Bail Organa, and basically say, you know, the real injustice here is the way you all have completely taken advantage of the sacrifices he made. He who has sacrificed more than you will ever sacrifice for this rebellion. You're going to stand on his shoulders and you're going to benefit from what he did. And you're going to turn around and talk about him like he was nothing. So even the good guys, right, in that respect, are not even building something that's going to last. And of course, by the time we get to the sequels, we see that it all falls apart anyway. So there is a real benefit to talking about the nature of sin in the world on an institutional level, which, by the way, is a very hot topic right now. It smacks of that, you know, neo-Marxist idea of everything being this great power struggle. And we love to talk about power for some reason right now. And this is a good way to lean into those conversations. And it gives you sort of a natural cultural artifact to talk about. Thirdly, I would say there, and you've even raised this point, there's this total, near total absence of transcendence. There is no force. There's no force. There's no spiritual longing. The universe is closed. That gives Christian viewers a very unique angle into this. We can ask, well, what happens in a world with no hope beyond resistance? What does it mean to fight when you don't even believe in ultimate justice or redemption? Andor is compelling, I would say, precisely because it aches for a kind of transcendence that it itself won't allow, which is very true to the experience of people. This is why I say you have to be quite careful when someone says, oh, I resonate with that because it's the way things are. You can resonate with it, not necessarily because it's the way things are, but because it is common to your experience in the sense that one aches, one longs for, to use C.S. Lewis's words, longs for, naturally longs for, a kind of transcendence in the world that one's epistemology, that one's thinking, that one's views on truth simply will not allow for. This ultimately is why atheism is a very short-lived phenomenon. As I tell my Bible students, we sort of here in the West talk about atheism as if it's the big bad. It's not. Atheism was very short-lived. It's going to go with Richard Dawkins. Chris Hitchens is already gone. And I've always sort of liked Hitchens more than the rest of them. But you're more likely to go out on the street, grab the average person and say, do you believe in God? And they go, I don't know. Then they say, well, no. Because the past 30 years, as religion has re-infiltrated the public sphere, when modernity worked so hard to get rid of it, has shown us, if anything, that you can't actually get rid of something like spirituality. You can't really get rid of that longing for something transcendent. And this show aches for that, as most people do, but within a framework that it itself won't allow for. So while it's not a, Andor is not a religious show, but it is an intensely theological one, especially in its subtext, asking these questions about belief and sacrifice and really meaning in a universe that really seems pretty indifferent to you. And that sort of all makes it worth talking about.
I would say that's very true of Andor. Like you said, it's just, it has that kind of like you're a cog in the wheel of this impersonal universe that you live in. And even relationally, it seems that way. It's very devoid of many really meaningful relationships and community that we think of. I think even the way they portray the rebels and the rebellion seems a little different than the 1977 or George Lucas when he was doing that. It's just a little bit more fragmented, a little bit more everybody out for themselves. So it's a very interesting contrast between that and the original film, for sure.
Yeah, I joked with one of my filmmaker friends that if Tony Gilroy made The Empire Strikes Back, it would open with Luke Skywalker having nightmares of blowing up the Death Star. And his arc for the rest of those movies would not be Vader and daddy issues. It would be him wrestling with the guilt of what he did. And Han Solo would be punished for returning to help them. That's the way the Star, if you're looking at it from the framework of Andor and we're telling the Star Wars story all over again from that perspective, that's how that story would go. Han might return for ulterior motives or not return at all. And then Luke would just be haunted with survivor's guilt the rest of the time. That's what Star Wars would be.
Well, I'm sure we've given everybody a lot of food for thought if they hadn't thought of kind of comparing how Andor fits into the whole Star Wars universe, literally. And so I hope that's some good things to think through for the Christian apologists out there, even if you're in high school or college, because everyone's going to be talking about this series because people love Star Wars. So on a much lighter note, or I don't know if it's lighter, given everything that we just talked about, what would you say is some of your favorite Star Wars, either TV series or films? And what about the person who kind of tuned into this, you know, is vague? There are people out there who have never seen Star Wars. So do you have a recommendation of where someone should really focus their attention on and kind of like don't Google stuff, just kind of watch it like you have for the first time type of thing?
Personal favorite stuff. I mean, the originals are great. I grew up with the prequels, so I'm partial to them, though they are rough. I don't think the sequels are as bad as everyone says. As far as TV shows go, I like the first season of The Mandalorian. That's a good inroad to the TV shows. I wanted to like Obi-Wan Kenobi more than I did. For kids, the natural starting point would be the animated TV shows. They're very good. And if you've never seen Star Wars, the great debate, do you start with the prequels or the originals? Well, it depends on your mileage. What I've always said is if you know the twist, the great reveal in The Empire Strikes Back, if you know that already, start with the prequels. Go in order. Go in viewing order. The way that, you know, we would say the author or Lucas, the author intended the story to be read. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you know the twist. If you don't know the twist and you're going in completely blind, start with the originals and watch them in production order.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 448 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written a TV series review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called "We Used Up All the Perfect, Andor and the Limits of Star Wars."
You can read this review completely free. There's no paywall at equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.